and iTunes International. From the golden sands of Bondi Beach across your world.
You're listening to Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting around your world. I'm Henry in Sydney, Australia. As the jingle just pointed out, I'm on Bondi Beach. I'm very happy to have our Irish correspondent Declan Hughes on the line from my and our home city of Dublin. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back, Henry. I'm also your European correspondent to a degree, and that's the focus of what our conversation is going to be today.
Yes, and where do we start?
Well, we start in Poland. Now, we're going to be looking at three countries during this piece, Henry. And the one thing they have in common is all or parts thereof, of all of these three countries we're going to be looking at, were all once former subject nations of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And the former conservative politician Michael Portillo, who does a television series on British television, which if you can catch up with it, and I'd recommend you, any listener, do, called Great Railway Journeys, well worth a look. Brilliant historian, incidentally. Would never have voted for the guy, but what a historian. He did a very interesting series on the War of Independence in Ireland, and it was brilliantly done. It was a BBC joint production. Very, very good. We celebrated our centenary as a nation there a couple of years ago, and it was part of that. It was very, very well done. Anyway, to get back to Michael Portillo for a second, he did a journey around Europe using a 1912 Bradshaw's Guide to World Railways. And he went to all the places mentioned in the book, basically. But when he got to southern Poland, he discovered that Poland in 1912 was partly governed by the German Empire, partly governed by the Russian Empire, and the southernish bit was governed by the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which is something that has in common with the other two countries we're going to be talking about later on in this piece. So we start with Poland. Poland had elections earlier this year, and the ruling Law and Justice Party under Prime Minister Morawiecki are called the Law and Justice Party, and they had ruled in Poland since 2015. And despite the fact that they'd been in government for 8 years, they were still returned as the largest party, but their vote was down significantly. In the 2019 elections, they had gotten 43.9% of the vote, but this year they only got 35.4% of the vote. And this was despite the turnout being 74.4%, which is a pretty good turnout.
That's
for an election.
That's a high turnout, yes.
Yeah. Now, the Polish parliament, which is known as the Sejm, is basically... The seats came back as follows. Law and Justice, the PIS party, 194 seats. Now, the Civic Coalition is led by a former EU commissioner called Donald Tusk, and he got 157 seats directly for his organisation. But they were proposing to form a coalition government with two other parties. The Third Way, who got 65 seats, and a bunch known in English as the Left, who got 26 seats, and their combined total would have given them 248 seats, which I'm sure you can, when you tell you there's only one party left, the Confederation, with 18 seats, I'm sure you can see that would be enough to rule a parliament of that size.
Sure.
Now, the opposition also boosted its control of the less powerful upper chamber, the Senate. And what one of the benefits of a Donald Tusk-led government, who would be seen as being more EU-friendly, was that 8 years of an unresolved standoff with the EU under former Prime Minister Morawiecki over migration would end, because the new government would reverse controversial judicial reforms and institutions of the PIS government, which is a prerequisite for Brussels releasing 34.5 billion in frozen EU funding to the Polish government. So the economy of Poland will benefit by this move to a Donald Tusk-led administration. And this is despite the fact that the Law and Justice, who would be seen as a not very pro-Brussels party, still were the biggest party despite losing a share of their vote.
How is Poland doing? During the height of COVID, how did Poland cope?
I'm not sure they coped that well during COVID. They were doing quite well up to the COVID era. We had seen in the noughties a lot of Polish immigrants like Ireland and Great Britain and other EU states. And a lot of the workers that came here were working construction. This was just before the big financial collapse in 2008.
Yes.
And then when 2008 happened, a lot of the Polish construction workers went to London to work on building the facilities for the London 2012 Olympics. And as soon as the 2012 Olympics was finished, they moved back home and started rebuilding their own economy. And during the teens, the 2010s, as they're sometimes known, the Polish economy back home was doing quite well. And they were enjoying a little bit of prosperity at a time when other parts of Europe weren't doing that well at all.
Yeah, and I noticed I was in Dublin around about the same time, 2009, I was there. And of course, the fallout from, you know, the terrible, you know, economic crisis, if you like, I went into a McDonald's. And now, given that I grew up in Dublin and Ireland generally, you didn't see foreigners behind a counter in McDonald's. And it was kind of a culture shock to me because I hadn't been in Dublin for so many years. And I came back and I noticed that there was a lot of Polish in Dublin, actually.
Yeah, and I got to know some Poles as well. And I used to eat in an Italian restaurant where I used to live. It's since changed hands. It's not owned by the same family anymore. Yeah. And they had a very nice Polish waitress, and she was living in an area not far from, I was living in Donaghmede at the time, which is a suburb on the north side of Dublin. And they were living in a very, very close by suburb called Clongriffin. And she was saying that all her neighbors in the apartment block she was living in Clongriffin were Polish, and herself and her husband decided to move out. And I said, why? She says, I don't want to grow up in a Polish ghetto. I don't want my children growing up in a Polish ghetto.
He said, we
moved to Ireland to assimilate with Irish people. And I thought that was a very interesting and brilliant attitude, to be honest.
Fair enough.
it would have been a great comfort zone to have, surrounded by people from home. And we had a lot of Polish supermarkets at the time. You could go in and buy. We still have one or two, but at the time we had a higher population. We had a lot more Polish supermarkets, and occasionally you go down the main streets of Dublin, and you'd see this very attractive young lady in Polish traditional costume offering you things like Polish sausage meat to try. And stuff like that to try and lure you into their supermarkets. A great, great idea and a lovely example of what positive things that migration can bring to a country.
And Declan, I do concur with you. A lot of Asian people who come to Australia, and I'm not trying to be racist to anyone, but they tend to stick together. And the other thing is you don't learn the English language too well if you're, you know, surrounded by people who speak the same, your native language.
But that was the attitude of the Polish lady that I got to know in the Italian restaurant.
Yes, well done, her. Yeah.
To show you an example of how cosmopolitan the staff were, they had Irish waitresses, they had a Czech chef, and they had Italians, obviously, because they were an Italian family that owned the restaurant. And the Czech chef and I bonded over our mutual love of Czech music. And I remember one day I went into the restaurant, this just before we start the formal part of things. And she was very down the dumps. And I said, what happened? And she says, I don't know if you heard the news. She says, Peter Muck died. Mm-hmm. And Peter Muck is one of my favorite Czech singers. Oh. Apparently what happened was the lad was in his 50s. And the wife got up in the middle of the night to go and use the bathroom. And when she came back, she found her husband stone cold dead in the bed.
Gosh.
He'd got a heart attack while she was on the john, so to speak.
Oh my God. How awful. Yeah. How awful.
Yeah, great, great singer. Incidentally, we haven't discussed this earlier, but if you wanted to play a song by him, I'll send you how to find the best song that I know by the guy. It's my favorite Czech song, but he was a great singer and a really good performer.
Soon.
So anyway, so that's the situation there. But again, so the polls in Ireland went mostly from the construction industry, went to other parts of the world and went back home to Poland. So Poland, in the context of what we were talking about, Poland were doing relatively well in the teens. But the former prime minister we talked about, Morawiecki, he got into power in 2015, his party. But again, his vote came down from 43.9% in 2019 to 35.4% earlier this year. So obviously some of the people that had previously voted for him had enough. And he had a very strong anti-migrant stance. And he also wasn't a huge fan of he wasn't a huge fan of the EU, because it said like he was opposed to their migration policies. Now, there's a lot wrong with EU migration policies, but if you've got 35 billion riding on your attitude to migration policies, you'd have to, even with a population of 40 odd million, you'd have to think about possibly maybe reining in some of your public statements to try and make sure that you got that 35 billion that was earmarked for your country into the coffers, and you know, do something positive about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Was there much support for Poland in that time? In Europe, financially?
Well, financially, they were getting a little bit of aid because of the fact that they were so welcoming, relatively speaking, to the Ukrainian migrants. It was not other migrants they were having a problem with. Now, migration has been a problem all over Europe. And what we're going to do is we're going to focus on the second country where migration was seen as a huge problem, which is Hungary.
Yes.
Hungary is a border nation of the EU. Because to the south of Hungary, you have Serbia, which is where an awful lot of people migrated to try and get into the EU. And Hungary and Croatia are kind of like the southern bulwark of the EU against the rest of the non-EU European states. So migrants would kind of mass on the north Serbian, southern Hungarian frontier and try and get into Hungary. And this was causing all kinds of problems. And Viktor Orban and his party, Fidesz, were elected and they were trying to keep the migrants out, basically. Now, in 2012, they had an election in Hungary in April. And the Fidesz party won a fourth consecutive term in government, picking up two-thirds of the seats on 54.1% of the popular vote. Now, Hungary doesn't provide Ukraine with military support, despite being a member of both the EU and NATO. And Orban famously blew off a Zoom meeting with other EU states to discuss the Israel-Hamas situation to take a photo opportunity to shake hands with Vladimir Putin not so long ago. Ooh. He famously made a speech back in October on the anniversary of the 1956 uprising against the Soviet Union. And he described the EU as a bad contemporary parody of the Soviet Union. And he described the situation as follows. "We had to dance to the tune that Moscow whistled. Brussels whistles too, but we dance as we want to. And if we don't want to dance, then we don't dance."
Yes. That's a nice way of putting it. They were kind of stuck in the middle when you think about it.
Yeah, no, I understand his reservations about the fact that, you know, they were the front line and they weren't getting a lot of help from the other EU states. You see, one of the reasons for the migration policy of the EU states is a thing called the population time bomb. Have you heard of the population time bomb?
No, I have not.
Okay, the population time bomb is the following. The older part of your population gets so numerous that you don't have enough young people to pay enough taxes into the system to support them.
Yes.
And this has been happening in Europe on a consistent basis for the last 20 years or so. Is the reason behind Angela Merkel's policies with regards to opening the doors to migrants in Germany. They were hoping they got enough productive young migrants into the state that there'd be enough young people paying taxes into the system to pay for all the old pensioners.
Yeah, just an offside to this. You know, I've been talking a lot about China lately, and they're running out of young people.
The birth rate's falling. And again, they're going to face the same population time bomb that we've been facing in Europe for the last 20 years.
Yes. Is this because people are, you know, young women are, you know, choosing to work, and it's a whole different ball game than, say, the 1970s?
It was state policy to only have one child for a long, long time.
Yes.
And now what happens is there are so few young people in this generation compared to previous generations that men are finding women hard to find. Women are finding men hard to find. And this is the big problem. a lot of Chinese young people have emigrated to other parts of the world where there was no limit on the amount of children you could have.
Including Australia, of course.
Populations all in Australia, but we have them in Ireland as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And if they come here, they can have five kids if they can afford it.
You know the Celtic Tiger that was going on in the 90s? And of course, was kind of, you know, the GFC kind of put a stinger on that one in 2007, 2008. Is Ireland, you know, someone said to me on YouTube, well, they wrote to me after something I saw on YouTube, and they said Ireland is the wealthiest country in Europe. Surely not, Declan.
The figures would say that we are, but we have a lot of problems.
Mm.
There has been, ever since the governments of the 1990s that included the Progressive Democrats, and I've said this before and I'll say it again, history is going to be very unkind to the Progressive Democrats, because two things happened under governments that were led by the big parties but propped up by the Progressive Democrats. Two decisions were made, and I think they were Progressive Democrats' ideas. One was to scrap apprenticeships, and the other one was to stop the state building housing. The state built public housing from its foundation in the 1920s right up through to the 1990s. Do you remember the corporation and council houses that there were?
Oh, yes, I do. Yes.
They don't exist anymore.
Really? Those high-rises were dreadful anyway, weren't they?
Yeah, but the high-rises were dreadful, but they were building, like for years they were building terraced houses. They built Crumlin, Kimmage, Ring, you know, all over Dublin.
Hmm.
Yeah. And all over the country as well, like in towns like Ennis and Middleton and all what have you,
yeah.
The Cork County Council, the Clare County Council, and so on would build housing.
Yeah.
And it was, we never had a housing crisis until the last 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
And there are so few construction workers left in the country. And because of the lack of apprenticeships, nobody's being trained up in the skills necessary to build the houses. Because we have a burgeoning population. The population of the island of Ireland, Henry, is the highest it's been since the 1850s.
Yes, and of course it was a very high population in the 1850s when the, obviously emigration to both the UK and America, due to the famine, of course, or Sinead O'Connor said there never really was one, but that's another story.
Well, Henry, we came down from a population estimated around 9 million at the height of the famine to about 6 million in 1851, which we have actual figures for.
Yeah.
And the population of the island of Ireland is nudging 6 million now.
It's getting back there.
Yeah, because the most recent population census in Northern Ireland, it was just under 2 million. And the population of the Republic was just over 5.
Right. So this population now is for the entirety of Ireland or just the Republic?
Yeah. But there's a housing crisis in both parts of the island.
Yes. Right. And, you know, heaven knows when that's going to end. You wanted to talk about Czechoslovakia, which you briefly mentioned earlier on in our broadcast. What's going on in Czechoslovakia?
Well, it's Slovakia more so than Czechoslovakia. Just to give a bit of background to the listeners. Czechoslovakia was two basically distinct nations formed into one country in 1919 when the Austro-Hungarian Empire was dismantled. And they were a democratic country until the 1930s. Of course, they were invaded by the Nazis in 1939. Famously, people might remember Germany annexing part of Czechoslovakia, the Sudetenland, the year before the war broke out.
Mm.
After the war, about 1948 or 49, the communists took over. And they were under the Soviet sphere of influence for many, many years. Now, in the 1960s, under the leader of the Czechoslovakian Communist Party was a man from Slovakia called Anton Dubček. And he tried to bring in reforms in 1968. And alarm bells went off in Moscow. And the Warsaw Pact nations decided to have military maneuvers in 1968. And effectively, Dubček was overthrown. Now, he was replaced by another man from Slovakia called Gustav Husák, and he was a much more of a hardliner. Mm. Now, he later explained his actions when the communist regime had been replaced under a thing called the Velvet Revolution in 1989. I'll tell you a bit more about that in a few minutes.
Sure.
He explained his actions as his efforts as leader of Czechoslovakia were to kind of... what's the word I'm trying to think of? You know the way you pour water into something to thin it out?
Yes, dilute.
Yeah, well, he was trying to minimize the effect of the hardline Soviet policies on his people as much as he could. So he was kind of saying, look, I know I was taking the hardline view, but I was trying to minimize its effects on the population. And that's what motivated me. Now, I I wouldn't totally dismiss that as possibly what was going on, but his effectiveness at doing that was witnessed by the fact that he was trying to get the Soviets to withdraw their troops as early as the 1970s from Czechoslovakia, and they only finally left in 1991.
Gosh.
But anyway, under his policies, he was trying to encourage the birth rate to go up in both parts of what used to be Czechoslovakia. And so from 1970 to about 1974, 75, they had a policy whereby they made maternity leave easier to get. And there was kind of cash payments paid to mothers having children and so on and so forth. Much more attractive than it ever been before.
Yeah.
So the children born in this period are known as Husak's children. And at the end of our piece about Slovakia, I'm going to introduce a song by a band called Chinaski from the Czech Republic called 1970, which was seen as the beginning of this policy. And that's where the phrase Husak's children comes from. It was in the lyric of the song. Anyway.
Yes.
So that's the legacy. In 1989, the communist regime fell and was replaced by a democratic regime in Czechoslovakia under President Václav Havel, who had been a dissident under communism and had been a member of the Charter 77 organization that were looking for better human rights for people living under communist rule at the time. He was a famous writer. And in 1993... Because the transition of power from communism to non-communism was seen as peaceful, it was called the Velvet Revolution. And that was followed in 1993 by the decision of Slovakia to vote for independence. And that was called the Velvet Divorce.
Yes.
And the Czechs and the Slovaks are very good neighbours to this day. They both joined the EU. They work together. They both joined NATO. They've operated hand in glove in terms of mutual foreign interests, tourism, agriculture, all kinds of things. They've worked together as very good allies ever since independence. And the relationship between the Czech government and the Slovakian government is excellent to this day. And to be fair to all the governments of both countries, this is regardless of which party is in power. This has been across the political divide in both countries.
Isn't that really unusual? I mean, because they've separated as states, they still remain friendly, and this is not a usual story with that scenario, if you like.
Yeah, well, I think in fairness to the Slovaks saw their period of rule as Czechoslovakia, particularly when it was democratic, as being largely benign. And in the same way that Irish people migrate to London in looking for better work opportunities, Slovaks migrate to Prague to do the same thing.
Yeah.
It's a very similar dynamic. There's a lot of Slovakian musicians are very popular in the Czech Republic, like the way a lot of Irish musicians get very successful in the UK.
Mm.
Now, to get down to the brass tacks of this election,
yes.
Robert Fico, who was a former prime minister, was leading an organization called SMER, SD. And they won 42 seats in the 2013 election. A brand new party called HLAS won 27 seats. There's 150 seats in the National Council, and you need 76 for a majority. So Fico's SMER party and the HLAS, who initially were running in their first election, and another party called the SNS, formed a coalition government. And Fico was asked by the president to try and form a coalition government. Now, there were delays because one of the parties were seen as being unconstitutional in their policies by the president. The president, who's a lady, incidentally, I forgot to write down her name. She said, no, you can't have this party in your government. They're against the constitution of our country. And so they got another party in instead, and they were also proposing to have a minister of the environment who was a climate change denier. Mm. And the president said, you can have all your ministers except that person. So they replaced that person and they formed a government, and they took up office on October 25th. Now, their policy is they don't support funding the war in the Ukraine. And they also want to be a bit more anti-EU than other parties in their country. And the ironic thing about this was there was a recent opinion poll carried out in Slovakia about who the Slovaks wanted to win the Ukrainian-Russian war. And the vast majority of Slovakian people want Ukraine to win the Ukraine-Russian war. So this particular policy they have about not funding the Ukraine war kind of flies in the face of what the people of Slovakia seem to want.
Right.
So it's just an interesting take on it.
Yeah, it is an interesting take. Does that cause friction?
I don't know, because the government's only been in power for a month, so we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, it'd be sad if it did, given that they have a good relationship with each other. I wanted to mention to you something that came as a surprise to me, and that is that the EU, as in the European Community, has been around since 1993. And I do find that interesting because I didn't realise that. It's only recently, you know, with the whole Brexit thing going on in Britain, that I realised that the EU has actually been around a long time.
Well, the EU began as the European Economic Community as far back as 1957 under
That's
the Treaty
right.
of Rome.
And
there were six
was
nations
formed,
at the
yes.
time. Yeah, there were six nations at the time. I think it was France, Germany, Belgium, Luxembourg, the Netherlands. How many is that? Four?
That's four, yeah.
That's five. France, Germany, Belgium, Luxembourg, Netherlands, and, of course, Italy. That was in six.
Right. And that was
and
in 1957.
Hmm. In 1973, we joined with the British and Denmark. So
I remember as well. We were 11 years old.
They famously had a soccer match in Wembley where the six took on the three. Yeah, it was a selection of players from England, Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Denmark, and the Republic took on the original six. A team representing the original six nations. And I don't think there's been a match like that since. There's been massive expansions of the EU, but they haven't had similar soccer matches since. But I thought that was an interesting thing. It just struck me as something that stuck out in my mind. Northern Ireland supplied the goalkeeper, actually, Pat Jennings, an absolute great of the game. And he's had health issues, and I wish him well. I know his son. I digress. It's kind of evolved into a kind of a, as Viktor Orban describes it, as a contemporary parody of the Soviet Union in terms of it seems to be trying to evolve into being a kind of a super state. Now it is the fourth largest economy in the world at the moment.
Well, really?
Yeah.
Gosh.
After China, India, the USA, the fifth largest economy in the world, I think, is Indonesia.
Ah, just up the road from us.
Just up the road from you guys, yeah. Mm. But so that's a that's an interesting thing. And that's one of the reasons why Donald Trump was in favour of Brexit. Because he was fearful that EU would become number three and the States would go down to number four. So by encouraging Britain to leave the EU, it made the EU smaller and preserved USA's position in the pecking order.
Mm. Gosh. Yes, Trump seems to pop his head up everywhere, doesn't he?
Yeah. Well, on another occasion, I'm going to explain to you why China is going to win the Ukraine-Russian war, regardless of who wins on the battlefield.
Yes. Good friends with Putin.
Yeah, but they're...
And
they're
Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, but they're also not completely alienating themselves from the EU and other parts of the world, as you will see. They recently signed a trade deal with Ireland.
Oh. Doing what? Trading what?
We're sending them more food.
Oh, okay. Right. Well, yeah. That's a good thing. Ireland have been known as one of the most generous countries in the world, which is an interesting thing to me. And the second one, as far as I understand, is Indonesia.
Mm. Well, I'm not sure what's going on in Indonesia, but I can explain the Irish thing. We are particularly generous when it comes to giving aid for famines. That's because we have a folk memory. We had a famine of our own less than 200 years ago.
Yes, of course.
And other nations of the world were very kind to us. There was a tribe of Indians in America called the Choctaws who sent aid to Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
The Ukrainians sent a ship of grain, which was hijacked by the British Navy and redirected to a British port.
Sorry, I have to correct myself. It's Ukraine that is the second for giving.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because neither of these countries are wealthy, Ireland or Ukraine.
Yeah. Well, Ukraine, even though it was part of the Russian Empire, sent a ship of grain to try and feed the hungry Irish, which I, you know, to this day, I and again, we have a folk memory of this. So that's why we're giving, you know, that's why we're allowing so many Ukrainian refugees and they're being made fed welcome. It's kind of like they're benefiting from the generosity of their ancestors.
Are they coming in like on ships or are they just welcomed?
They're coming in on all kinds of transportation.
They're via Britain, obviously.
Yeah, but one of the problems we have is we're running out of accommodation for them, and some of them had to be accommodated in tents as recently as 6 weeks ago.
You know, what interests me is that, you know, we have this problem in Australia as well, where these rich people in Canberra, which is our capital city here, they come down to a place called Batemans Bay, which I lived in briefly back in the mid-90s. And these houses are left empty all winter long. And there's an accommodation crisis going on.
Yeah, we have a similar thing in the west of Ireland where people have holiday homes. It tends to be rich Germans and Americans, and they come over and they spend like a month or so there. And sometimes people will come and spend maybe the summer there when they're retired. But they go back home because they don't like our winters, our winters are a lot nicer than some other countries' winters we can mention. But anyway, but be that as it may, and we have these holiday homes as well, like you say, empty for 6 to 9 months a year.
What do you think of that?
I don't know what you can do about it. I mean, unless you force them to go on Airbnb, I don't know how much you can do. I mean, the Airbnb option might be an option because at least they'd be earning some money from them.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Another thing, I'm sorry, I keep going off the subject here, but golf courses.
Now, yeah.
I have spoken to someone about this recently on air, and there is a lot of sentiment about golf courses. Here on Bondi Beach, we have a massive golf course. It's owned by very wealthy people. It's privately owned. And a lot of people have a problem with this because it's for the wealthy. And, you know, they say, why can't we build houses for the poor people? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, interestingly enough, the cost of land is becoming prohibitive in different parts of the world. And what we're seeing now is we're seeing golf courses that are only building 9-hole courses because they can't get enough land for 18.
Especially in the cities.
Yeah. So what you're going to see is you're going to see smaller golf courses being built, which will mean that there will be, by default, more land available for housing. Mm. But that could take time to kick in as regards an after effect of the price of land, shall we say. So it's basically a watch this space situation, and each country will have its own peculiar idiosyncrasies of its market and so on. But that is going to be, within 5 to 10 years, that's going to be a real issue.
Yeah, interesting. I just want to get back to the Czech Republic and Slovakia, as we now call them. What does the rest of Europe think about this?
Well, again, it's just what you see is the lurch to the right that we've seen in some of the countries bordering the non-EU nations, the likes of Poland and Hungary and so on, Romania is another country that's in the front line, because Romania and Bulgaria, they border the Black Sea, so they would get refugees from Ukraine particularly, and Bulgaria probably is subjected to refugees trying to get into the EU from Turkey and from Asia, so they're having issues on their borders as well, as would Greece. You know, so there's a lot of states there that are having problems with migrants, and it's a huge issue. And a lot of these people are not genuine refugees. A lot of them are just economic migrants. And this is a problem that a lot of states have. Look, we'll help refugees who are in real trouble, but everybody else can take a hike, basically, you know.
How do you work that out, though? I mean, you don't know who's coming to your shores.
One of the big issues, and this is a serious issue, and I do not wish to appear to be anti-immigrant in any way.
Sure.
But if you're going to bring in large numbers of people from foreign countries who may have a natural immunity to diseases back home that we don't know about, so they could be carrying these viruses, but they don't have any symptoms.
They could do an Ellis Island on them, couldn't they?
They have to have medical checks, and they're not being given medical checks.
Yeah, that's a problem.
And that can create a massive problem. Because apart from anything else, if they bring this disease from back home, and they move into an area with people who are originally from back home who no longer have this immunity, incidentally, they could spend a pandemic amongst the wrong people.
Yeah, that's a big deal, isn't it?
Yeah. That causes a massive health crisis for the country that's hosting them, you know?
Yeah, for sure. So generally speaking, it's a welcome move with these new states in Europe as a whole. In Ireland, it is relatively new with immigrants when you think of the passage of time.
Yeah, but you are seeing the occasional right-wing backlash. I mean, there are organisations setting up, like saying, and it's a legitimate point, although it appears racist on the surface. Why are we providing homes to foreigners when we have such a big homeless crisis? Should we not prioritize our own people first? That's a legitimate argument, but if you express it, you are seen to be racist. When in fact, we should look after our own first and then build extra houses for the people coming in. You know.
Yes, and never mind the houses. I was going to ask you, what is the job situation in Ireland for the Irish? What is the percentage of unemployment?
It's very low at the moment. They claim to have almost full employment. Now, I know almost full employment means unemployment levels below 5%, because there's enough jobs out there for the 5%. It's just the 5% can't be bothered to look for them. That's the view.
Yeah, they call them dole bludgers in Australia. Is that a fair thing to call them in Ireland?
But I mean, the thing is you can have skills in a certain sector and there might be no vacancies in that particular sector and you don't want to take a job doing something else because you're not trained for it, you know. There is an element of that too. Like your particular sector might be oversubscribed for employees. You know, there's a little bit of that too. But there are great skill shortages by the same token in other areas. And they're having to bring in immigrants with those skills because we don't have enough of them at home.
Yeah, see, this is a common problem, isn't it? Is there a sense that those who are on the dole, they call it Centrelink in Australia because we're so polite about names, but let's call a spade, it's the dole. Are they lazy? Could we call them dole bludgers, or is that unfair?
Well, it is unfair. I mean, one of the problems we have in this country is we weren't very good at teaching languages, even our own.
Yes.
And those chickens are now coming home to roost, because you'd see a job advertised, you know, IT skills in a foreign language, and we can't supply that cohort at home. Mm. So I'll give you an example. A friend of mine from Eastern Germany, he saw an ad online. They were looking for a fellow with IT skills in German. Well, German was his mother tongue. He was pretty good at English. Moved here. He's been living here the last 10 years.
Yeah.
The Irish market didn't have anybody with IT skills in German capable of doing the job.
Well, that's perfectly legit, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. But I mean, there could have been somebody with IT skills and no German who didn't get the job because he didn't have German, you know.
Yeah, but what about those who are taking potentially Irish jobs? Is there a negative sentiment amongst Irish people about that?
Not at the moment. I think, as I said, largely because of the fact that there is a reasonable level of employment in the country as a whole. But I'd say if the unemployment situation gets worse, but I mean, a lot of the jobs that a lot of foreigners do in across the whole range of economies, and Ireland is no exception to this, it's basically work the Irish don't want to do.
Yep, this is very similar with many countries, including Australia. They're just not wanting to do these dirty jobs, as they call them.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you're working in an office and you're still there when the cleaners arrive, guaranteed the cleaner won't be Irish.
Yeah, and that's...
But nobody wants to clean offices who's Irish. Yeah. That's the fact of the matter.
It kind of spoilt in a way when you think about it.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. I mean, like, I don't have anything against people who... I think cleaning is a perfectly legitimate job.
And, absolutely.
And the great thing is the bloody office will be dirty again the following day, so you've got more work to do, you know?
I want to quote a movie from 1985, The Breakfast Club, and the cleaner comes in to the classroom while they're all doing detention. I don't know if you've seen this movie, The Breakfast
Club. I've
seen
bits of it, yeah.
He comes in and they're sort of taunting him and he says, if I didn't do what I do, you'd be in a mess. And they all just open their mouths.
Yeah.
And nothing to say about that.
I have said before, and I'll say it again, who are the four most important people from the public health perspective?
Okay, go for it.
You've got your doctors,
mm-hmm.
your toilet cleaners, and your bin men, right?
Yeah.
If they don't do their job, disease spreads, and the doctors are overworked. So your doctors, your bin men, and your toilet cleaners are three of the most important people in your society.
And I just want to mention, in 1979, Margaret Thatcher got into power in Britain. And this was following a dreadful Labour government experience, which ended in a bin strike. And London in the summer stank.
Yeah. And there was an outbreak of rat. There was a rat invasion.
Yes, yes.
And all kinds of problems. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And they reckon that's how the Tories got into power for so long, because people remembered.
Yes.
The stinking streets, the rat infestation, and so on.
Then, of course, when the poll tax came along in the early 90s, that was the end of Thatcher, I think.
That was the end of Thatcher, yeah.
Mm. Look, before we go, we will play at the end, and you will introduce us to it. Chinaski?
Chinaski and 1970. Okay, I'll use the English title because there's no point in trying to translate numbers into a foreign language.
Fair enough. I just want to quickly talk about radio because that's what we do. We're both in the radio industry. Do you listen to Irish radio? And if so, you've got a plethora of commercial stations there now, unlike the pirate days. Do you find that you listen to commercial radio in Ireland?
Not very much, no.
I don't listen.
I don't listen to state radio much either, to be honest.
RTE, yes.
Yeah, I don't listen to that very often either. I find that what I tend to listen to on the radio tends to be occasional. If I know something particular is coming up, the community radio station I'm working on at the moment seems to be changing its format. I used to do four shows on the station. I'm down to one now.
Why is this?
Well. My Sunday sports show is gone because we couldn't get staff to man the sound desk on a Sunday. Mm. The last two engineers we got were students, and they had to get part-time jobs to fund their education. And the part-time jobs insisted they work on Sundays. So that was the end of that. But there seems to be a complete difference of emphasis in the way the station is going. And like all the sports programs, bar two, are gone from the schedule. My soccer show has survived, and there's a new sports show on a Saturday, which consists of score updates from leagues overseas and other bits and bobs and music. And that's the way it's going. We used to have an Olympic-based sports show on a Tuesday. That bit the dust some time ago. We had a GAA show on a Wednesday. That was replaced by a Paralympic sports show. Both of those are now gone. The rugby show on a Thursday bit the dust. I used to contribute to that. The weekend sports program, sports preview program, I should say, which used to go out on a Friday and then was moved to Saturday morning. I contributed to both of them when they were on Friday or Saturday. They're both gone as well. So and the motorsport show is gone on Tuesday as well. So there's only the soccer show and the new Saturday show. That's it. I continued to do that. I had to start a podcast, Henry, because I fallen in love with what the Americans call field hockey many years ago, and I'm now doing a podcast for Hockey Ireland called Hockey Mondays. So any of our listeners who are into field hockey, into Irish field hockey, that's where to find your hockey coverage.
And,
now.
And I should point out to our listeners internationally, Declan is on 103.2 Dublin City FM. It sounds like they've cut down on their sports content generally. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, but I'm not sure like how much longer they'll get away with that, because there's a license review coming up from the Broadcasting Association of Ireland in 2026. And I'm not sure all of these changes might necessarily comply with the requirements, you know? So,
yeah. Do you think that, you know, we've often talked about being on pirate radio back in the 80s. Do you think it was kind of all ruined when in 88, I think it was, they brought in a new law, which of course originally was written in 1929 and revised in 1931, which allowed for the pirates in Ireland to go nuts because the law was not in place. Do you think it ruined good radio when they had all these restrictions with new radio? They had talk time that you had to do, a certain amount of Irish music, which I guess is fair enough. But do you think it was the end of good radio? And I'm not being biased when I ask that question.
Well, I think the way things are going is definitely they're going away from good radio now, definitely. And I do think that the new legal commercials, shall we say, in the 1990s, they were less innovative than their illegal forebears, shall we say.
Yes. They had less freedom, of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
And still do have less freedom. It's all formatted. I don't listen.
The musical formatting is a disaster. absolute disaster, because basically it doesn't matter what radio station you listen to in Sydney, what radio station you listen to in Brisbane, what radio station you listen to in Jakarta, what radio station you listen to in Dublin. You're going to hear the same half dozen or 10 bloody awful modern songs on all the stations.
Yeah, and when I was working on Radio Nova, in all fairness, they did the same thing, but they had a lot more freedom on air. I'd be in the newsroom compiling news because I was a newsreader on Nova, and they would pipe the music into the newsroom while we're trying, myself and Bernie Jemison, were trying to compile the news, and we've gone, oh no, the same song. So this is not a new thing, but the presenters have much more freedom.
It's kind of like it's gone more like Atlantic 252 than anything, which is basically, I always refer to Atlantic 252 as the goldfish radio network.
Mm.
It was radio for people with the attention span of a goldfish.
And
you know?
It's gone, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, Radio Nova, yeah, you would hear the same songs quite frequently. But every fourth song, the disc jockey was able to pick something, an oldie.
Yes, and they were allowed to.
They're not allowed anymore.
No.
I was talking to a former colleague of mine whom you probably know, Liam Coburn.
Of course, I worked with him.
He works for Q102 now. He said to me some time ago, he says, it doesn't matter whether Declan Hughes is presenting the program, Henry O'Donovan is presenting the program, Liam Coburn is presenting the program, or a trained baboon is presenting the program. You're going to hear the same songs at the same time on the show, and it doesn't matter, and the presenter has no say in what songs are played.
Yeah.
Declan, he says, if you were in music radio today, you'd hate it.
Yeah, and so would I. I couldn't do it. I can't even listen to it, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
There's no way I'd do it.
That's one of the reasons why I love the music shows you put together, because that's the kind of radio I can relate to.
Yeah, and just to let our listeners know, I do 2 one-hour music shows. One is Love Is On The Air, which is a lot of love songs, although I tend to be rather rambunctious in my presentation of that. And the other one is Bondi Tunes Plus, music from the 40s to the 90s. And it's basically free radio, no restrictions, Declan.
Yeah. No, but that's like one of the reasons why the radio station I'm connected with was doing so well was that on the traffic show, which is the highest rated show they have, last survey listenership, they had the 7th highest listenership in the city of Dublin, and they had a peak listenership. The peak hour was 5 to 6 on a Monday, with something like 250,000 listeners.
This is pretty good.
Yeah, the previous host of the evening traffic show was a guy who's now working for RTE. Now, you'd hear the latest crap on his programme, but every so often he'd pick an oldie from left field, something that hadn't been played since about 1973, but probably should have been played many times since 1973.
Yes.
Wow, where did he get that from? And people used to tune into him, Henry, because of that.
Yeah,
and somebody once said to me, I love your radio station because you never know what's going to be played next. And now it's going the direction of very predictable, blah-de-dee-blah, bland, yellow pack version, because most of our staff are volunteers, yellow pack versions of the commercial stations.
Yeah, which is unfortunate. I just want to, something that just came to mind to me that just gone out of my mind all of a sudden because I have attention span difficulties. John Clark, who was probably one of the best, but the most popular broadcasters on the great Radio Nova, became head of Radio 2, as it was known by then, RTE, the national broadcaster, later known as 2FM. He ran that place for a while. And one day he just played loads of Radio Nova jingles. And I thought, that says it all. RTE, who had 2FM or Radio 2 back in the day, hated Radio Nova because it was blasting their audience out of the water in Dublin.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of the people that were on the station with you in those days ended up in RTE or other broadcasting outlets in Ireland and other places.
Yeah.
And, you know, that shows the caliber of people involved.
Yes.
But then the guy that owned Radio Nova had been a brilliant broadcaster in his own time, you know?
Chris Carey, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember hearing him on Radio Luxembourg back in the 70s.
I had to read the news after. He rarely went on his own station, Radio Nova, Chris Carey, but he did come on one night, and Sybil Fennell, head of news, was on with him, and it was. And I had to read the news at 7 o'clock, and I was really quite nervous because he's the boss. But I was just listening back to that recently. Someone sent it to me, and you know, it's worth noting for our English listeners or people around the world, because Radio Caroline broadcasts all over the world on long wave and short wave, and we're very popular in America. He was a DJ on Radio Caroline, which is also illegal because the BBC only really had the BBC light service, I think they called it at some point. So it was history repeating itself in the 80s, wasn't it, in Ireland?
Yeah, pretty much. And what the guys had done in the 60s was they operated on boats in international waters. If anybody wants to see a movie to get some idea what it was like, the English title of the movie is The Boat That Rocked, but there's some other, there's a different title in other parts of the world.
Yes,
but,
in America,
You get a feel for what being on the ships must have been like. But I'm not sure how otherwise realistic the movie was, but at least it depicted the conditions fairly well.
Yeah, and of course we were on land, but great times. Anyway, look, we must go. And now I know you want to play a song at the end of this, and I'll get you to introduce that. I'll just let our listeners know that I'm talking with Declan Hughes, our Irish correspondent in Dublin, and we must end now. Declan, would you like to present this song for us?
Yeah, this is a song by a Czech band by the name of China Ski, and this song is called 1970. And in the lyrics in Czech, it mentions the phrase Huzak's children, which we referred to during the interview a little bit earlier on.
Těžko ta léta vrátí zpět. Henry O'Donovan.